Welcome to a Bow Valley Christian Church podcast. We are about helping people find and follow Jesus. In this episode, you are listening to Cal Hultgren share his message titled, When Love Walked Among Us. Love gives us choices. This is from the series titled, These Three Remain. This message was broadcasted live July 2nd, 2023.
Well, hello, my name is Cal. I'm one of the pastors here at Bow Valley Christian Church. Many of you know we are in the middle of a series called These Three Remain. It's a deep dive into three hallmarks of Christianity: faith, hope, and love, where we're exploring biblical examples and also real life examples of how these things can be emulated in our lives and cultivated so that we can help people and help ourselves find and follow Jesus. So in doing so, we were wanting you to reflect on your own spiritual journeys, examine your own faith, and find renewal in hope, in the hope of God's promises, and learn how to express love in genuine ways. As Pete had mentioned earlier, and a number of you are aware of, there's a group of over 30 people that have been gearing up for a long time, over a year, to go to the Middle East, to the Holy Land. And so that's where they are right now. And they're going to be seeing various biblical sites, as we probably would assume. One of those sites that they're going to be passing by is called the Church of St. Anne. And you see a picture of it right up on the screen behind me. The Church of St. Anne was built there, believed to be the birthplace of Mary, the mother of Jesus. When the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem happened in 1170, 40 years after this church was built, it was converted into an Islamic educational institution. Most of Jerusalem was destroyed. This wasn't. It was converted into an institution. Years later, it was abandoned and then later gifted to the country of France by the Ottomans in the France's help of their battle. And so France restored it back to a church. This church resides in, there's different quarters of Jerusalem. This is the Muslim quarter near the gate that's now called the Lion's Gate, sometimes called St. Stephen's Gate. But in Jesus' time, it was called the Sheep Gate. Now, the church, just on a side note, is a beautiful place for those of you that like Gregorian chant to practice a little bit of Gregorian chant. The acoustics are just incredible to hear that. Well, beneath the church, there are layers of history. And so really, our story begins meters down below from the church, which back then was about ground level. In 1873, two pools were discovered. And in the last 100 years, archaeologists were able to accurately identify what those two pools were. Now, different translations in the Bible use different names for these pools, but currently, and the consensus is, the pools are the pools of Bethesda. And hence, where it leads us now to John chapter 5. So if you have your Bibles, feel free to pull them out, either digital or paper copy, and turn to John chapter 5, right in the beginning of the chapter. You can also follow on the screen behind me. Now there in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, there was a pool, which in Aramaic was called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. Let me just stop there. Jesus is most likely on his way to the temple, and he stops by this pool as it's just located really not that far outside the temple wall. It's a place where friends or family would drop off their sick or their injured, hopefully to find healing. Some commentators say that the name means outpouring pool, and others say it could mean pool of mercy. That's an interesting name. So it was a dropping off point for the needy and the broken. And if you can imagine, it probably didn't smell that nice either. Some people would maybe leave their loved ones or their friends for a long time. And some of those people who are left there not only could not move, but maybe had lost certain controls of bodily functions. And so you could just imagine in the heat of a Mediterranean day, it could be rather rank. Not maybe the best place to reside. But the reason why they were dropped off there is that there was this popular superstitious belief that at certain times an angel of the Lord would come and would stir the pool. The pool surface would ripple. And the first one into the pool would be healed. And so all these people waited expectantly for the surface to stir and then be the first one to jump in. That's why you probably, for some of you, if you're reading a translation that's not the NIV or the NLT or more modern translation, maybe you're reading from the King James, it would actually include verse 4. Your translations, if you're reading NIV, does not include verse 4. It jumps from 3 to 5, which is kind of interesting. But in verse 4, describes this superstition. And it was kind of assumed that it was probably inserted there to explain to the recipients of the Gospel of John why people were residing, because they wouldn't have lived in that area. They wouldn't have known why people were there. So it was kind of an explanation, but not in the earliest text, and hence their modern translations have taken it out. This idea of being beside a special waters is not new and not exclusive to this pool here. In Lourdes in southern France, they have a spa which many people believe have healing capacities. The Shrine of Guadalupe in Mexico City has thousands of crutches stacked against the walls where folks have believed to be healed. Even in Alberta, and the Lac de Saint Anne, the people believe that the lake has special healing properties, and so people gather from all around to stand in the water to be healed. Now, I have to kind of feel like that's a little bizarre and a little strange, and I can't explain it all. Do people actually get healed or do they not? I don't know. But right away, as I hear these stories and I think about these people residing around the pool, I start to think we have to be careful. Anytime that we start to put faith in the object and away from God, that's idolatry. That's a way of slipping into this idea of magic, that items have special properties, that we can use them at their will or at our will, or they have certain rules that work here and don't work there. They just have to be done a perfect way. And I think God is very concerned about that. So it's interesting that Jesus picks this place to show up. And if you think about it, it's probably not the best place to be because it's only one person that gets healed at a time. Now, the waters would stir up. There was, archaeologists have found that there's subterranean water systems that would come in every so often and would fill up the tank, and so that would cause a stirring, which probably led to this belief of mystical healing. But can you imagine being there and then you see the waters stir? The kind of cutthroat activity that would happen is people are crawling on top of each other, pushing each other back so they could be the first one. It's kind of like Christmas Eve when there was the one last special doll for your kid. And mothers and fathers are lined up at the door. As soon as the doors are open, they go running and they're elbowing people and kneeing people and throwing people into the aisles so that they can get the one. That's probably what would happen at this pool because they're human. And that's what we do to each other. We want to be the one who is healed. So I called it the pool of God's mercy, or that's what a lot of commentators call it. I think that that name is a bit of a cruel joke. If you think about it, it's a rather cruel joke. There's no promise of healing. There's the hope of it. but only for the one. So his chances are it's not going to be you. And so you lie there, hoping, waiting, expecting, waiting, disappointed because you missed your chance, waiting, waiting. Nope, didn't make it. Waiting again, waiting. It's kind of a pool of mockery in my mind, not the pool of mercy. It's a pool that's promised of healing, but chances are not for you. And yet this is where Jesus steps into a place of broken hopes, half-hearted steps of muck and mire and mourning. Verse 5, one who was there had been an invalid for about 38 years. He'd been lying there, probably not for 38 years, but he'd been in this condition for so, so long that was his mentality. That's what he was probably known himself for, as an invalid, as a person who couldn't be mobile on his own. And continually disappointed. And so I don't think he was lying there at that day, hoping, expecting. I think his friends just were in the habit of dumping him there. He was in the habit of sitting there and just probably feeling really, really down, really disappointed, probably very sorry for himself. Because he was never the one. You know, you kind of tap into that sometimes when, if you're ever part of picking a team, this is kind of the least favorite part for most people when they're wanting to play a game, is when people pick teams and the first person that gets picked, it's like, oh man, you know you're good at something when you're the first person to get picked. When you're the last person, it's like, do we have to take this person? And you don't even want to be on that team if you're the last person, because you just feel like, I'm just going to weigh you down. I'm going to hold you back. And obviously, I know that you don't want me. That's kind of how he's probably feeling. In fact, that's probably how everyone around that pool is feeling, that they are not the ones to get picked. What is your pool? What are you lying beside at the edge, hoping to be the first one, but never the first one? What is it that is ailing you, holding you back, helping you, or not allowing you to be in this broken state, and you're just wishing that would change, that you would be healed, that would be let go in your life, that would be exercised from your life? What is your pool of Bethesda? Well, then Jesus does this peculiar thing when he approaches this man. Verse 6. When Jesus saw him lying there, and he learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" Ouch. Like, have you ever thought about that? Like, how rude. Like, he's lying there. He's been coming. His friends have been dropping him off there. Why would Jesus say, "Do you want to get healed?" It's kind of like, obviously, I'm here. I'm trying to do something, though it's not working. But I think Jesus is asking the question because not only does this man need to consider, he wants us to consider that sort of question. Do we want to be healed? And I'm sure as the man was thinking of the question and it kind of dawned on him, yeah, do I? If we think about it, he's been doing this in this condition for almost 40 years. He's created a lifestyle of dependence, a lifestyle of reliance on other people, probably having to beg daily. So that's a career move. It's a mentality. It's a way of life. It's a way of seeing the world that he has lived in for 40 years. And for as horrible as that is, and miserable as that is, it's familiar. And sometimes even our familiar mess is very comforting. And we don't want to change that. Because the unfamiliar is too scary and unknown, and so we want to stay with our familiar. So I think it's actually a fair question. Do you want to be healed? I know many people today do not want to be healed, or rather be made well, which is actually Jesus' words. And I appreciate the text bringing this out, that Jesus doesn't just say, do you want to be healed? But he says, do you want to be made well? Which is a broader implication. It's not just the specific healing. It's a whole life renewal, a whole life change, a wholeness, if you will. Do you want to be made whole is really what Jesus is asking. And I think some people don't. Quite frankly, some people don't. Sometimes I don't. Because I know if I'm made whole, then I need to live out that reality. That I need to change. That I need to let go of stuff. And am I ready for that? It's interesting when we talk about healing. Healing is a powerful, wonderful gift. And there are some of you here that have been miraculously healed. And praise God for that. Praise God for that. That is a gift to you, a testimony of God's mercy and his power and his grace. Some of you are here and you're still waiting to be healed. But the reality is, if we're healed or we're not, at some point we're still going to suffer again. That some other part of our body is going to wear down and fall apart. And I wonder if when Jesus is saying, not just do you want to be healed, but do you want to be made well? He's really getting at something beyond just the physical. He's getting at something deeper, more eternal. Do you want to be made whole in your physicalness, but more importantly, your emotional and your spiritual state? Because there's a lot of us here right now who don't need crutches, don't have an apparatus that we bring into, like hooked up to an IV so that we can be here. We came in on our own two legs, on our own volition. We sat down with ease, without pain. But spiritually on the inside, there's a lot of brokenness. There's a lot of baggage. There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of us that are still sitting beside the pool going, I wish that would change. And I think when it comes to healing, healing is really Jesus's gift to say, I'm drawing you into something bigger. I'm giving you a taste of a bigger reality. And if you're willing to step into this healing, then you're going to understand that the healing is beyond just the physical, but the emotional and certainly the spiritual. I think Jesus' questions pierce the doubting, depressed heart of the sinner who wanted healing but had very little faith. Some of us right now, we have very little faith in maybe our marriage, maybe our work situation. We've asked for help and no one seems to care. Sometimes it seems like it only gets worse. There are many people in the same place as this man with this feeling of hopelessness. Now, some of us might be not there yet. We're still hopeful, but we're not ready to give up our human effort. And so we keep trying, we keep crawling, we keep getting closer. We think to the edge of that pool. Doesn't seem to be working that well, but we keep working harder or telling ourselves we just need to be working harder to believe more, to practice certain techniques, and that will fix ourselves. And then Jesus comes along, probably stoops down to the man's eye level, looks him in the eye, and says, "Do you want to be healed? Here's your chance. Don't look at the pool. Look at me. Look at me." It's interesting, the man's response. Verse 7, "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. So while I'm trying to get in, someone else goes in ahead of me." It's fascinating that when the sick man is offered help by Jesus, he doesn't give a simple yes or no answer to Jesus' question. He offers an excuse. Yeah, I'd like to, but I can't. And maybe he understandably laughed at the question. He almost felt like it was ridiculous. Maybe he coughed in some sort of sarcastic snort. Or maybe he was just so numb for decades of futile attempts. And he just shrugged it off. "I can't do it." Resignation is always a dangerous thing. Oftentimes filled with doubt, we refuse to answer a simple question and instead choose to give excuses. "I'm alone. No one's there to help me. It's all about me. Everyone has it better off than I do. This problem cannot be helped. This one, insurmountable. This one, God can't touch. There's too many things holding me back. My circumstances aren't quite right. The opportunity isn't perfect." Problem is that he looked in instead of looking up. And I think in a lot of ways we are like the sick man, that in some ways that we have illness in our very souls, that we are crippled and dying and alone and unable to help ourselves. Despair is our lot. And that sounds really depressing on a Sunday morning. And yet Christ does come to us in the midst of that and looks at us and asks the question, "Do you want to be healed?" Essentially, he's saying, "Do you want to be changed for the better? Do you want to be made whole?" We can't do it on our own. No one can do it for us. The perfect circumstance isn't going to be the right one. We're not going to find the bestseller on the bookshelf to read or the acclaimed podcast to answer our problems. Jesus is saying, "Look at me. Look at me. Look at me." But the pool. No. Forget the pool. Look at me. Look at me. But I'm trying here. Forget that. Look at me. But no. You don't get it. It's not about that. It's about the Savior. Verse 8. "Then Jesus said to him, 'Get up, pick up your mat and walk.'" It's interesting how Jesus really is giving this man a choice. He knows this man's condition. He knows what's best for him. He doesn't just reach out and heal him and say, "Okay, now you're better, go on your way." He asks him a question and he gives him a choice. "Are you wanting to get up? Grab your mat and walk away." And I was thinking about that as a parent. That is really hard. And some of you who are parents can relate to this. You look at your kids and you see maybe just choices that they are making. And you're like, "Oh, why? Why?" Or we think of our own lives and the choices that we made, and our parents are probably saying to us, "Why? I told you not to. And there was a good reason why you shouldn't have done that, but you still did. Why? And as a parent, you want to kind of force them to not make those bad decisions. You want to almost like grab them and get them out of the situation or force their hand to do the right thing. But that's not love. I think love is giving people choice. It's honoring their free will. That's what God does for us. You think about it, God creates Adam and Eve. He breathes his identity into them, gives them life, gives them this ideal space, this Garden of Eden, gives them all kinds of beautiful fruit to eat, but then gives them choice. There's one thing that I ask you not to do. It's not good for you. It's not going to help you. In fact, you will die if you do this. Please don't do it. But you've got all this other stuff. Choice. Now, we know what people, what Adam and Eve did is they took and ate the wrong fruit. But I think the loving action was giving them choice. As pastors, sometimes I'm counseling couples and I want to force them to do the right thing. Like I say, well, this is what you need to do. This is what you need to do. This, let me do this for you. But that's not loving. This doesn't really help them. That doesn't honor their free will. And so Jesus offers this man a choice. The moment he stood was the moment he made his choice. Now, I bet that bed was pretty nasty, probably worn through, maybe soiled, filled with sweat, probably bugs, certainly tears. You've been lying in it for a long, long time. And it's interesting that Jesus says, stand, so he demonstrates his choice, demonstrates the reality of his new situation. But why pick up your mat? And I'm not going to get into it, but there was actually a problem that resulted, and you can read it later, by him picking up his mat on this particular day. But Jesus says, I want you to pick up your mat. Why? Because I think Jesus was saying, you're walking away from your old life. That the reality, your reality has changed. You're not needing to come back here anymore. So pick up that old mat. You don't need to come back to this. Don't leave it behind as saying, oh, maybe just if tomorrow changes and I can't walk, at least I've got a spot to come back to. No, you're not going to need that anymore. And then Jesus says to walk forward, to walk into your new reality. Not to stand still, not to keep looking back, not to crawl back to that pool and say, oh, maybe this will really heal me. Maybe this is what's going to last. No, Jesus says to keep walking. Keep walking. I think as Jesus offered the invitation to get up, pick up his mat and walk, Jesus continually offers us that same sort of invitation. Do you want healing in your soul? Is there things that are still broken? Don't look to the water. Don't look to someone else. Look to him. Look to Jesus. And then stand. Pick up that mat and walk away. Walk into your new future, your new reality. I think God did more than just heal that man. I think Jesus forgave his sins. He gave him a new start, a fresh start, new hope. But it's interesting that the story doesn't quite end there with this man. If you jump down to verse 14, later it says, Jesus found him at the temple. And he said to him, See? You're well again. Stop sinning or something worse is going to happen to you. And I was wondering, why would Jesus say that? Like, he's just been healed. He's got this new life. Why would Jesus say, stop sinning? Otherwise, something worse is going to happen to you. And I thought, maybe he was a thief. Maybe this guy was picking the pockets of the other invalids around. Or maybe he thought, you know, how am I going to feed myself now that I can walk around and harder to beg? So maybe I have to pickpocket people in the temple courts. I don't know. The text doesn't say. But there is something about his old life that he was holding on to. Maybe it's an old attitude. Maybe it was the wrong way of thinking, of still blaming other people for his lack of opportunity, blaming other people for not trusting in God wholly. Maybe still waiting for perfect circumstances to be faithful to God. Whatever it was, Jesus said, you stepped into your new life. Live it. Demonstrate it. And in that way, stop sinning. As I said, I think Jesus is interested in making us all well. Not all of us will be healed physically, but his primary goal is to heal us spiritually. I may have shared this story with you before, but it's a powerful story, and I think it's very apt in this passage here. My mom was a member of this congregation for a number of years, and on Mother's Day, she was diagnosed, or she had a seizure, and then right after that was diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer. And the doctor said the prognosis isn't good, you won't be around too long. And certainly that's devastating for anyone, and she was rather devastated. She wanted to be around for her grandkids' wedding days and watching them grow up and taking them places and having sleepovers and just wonderful experiences and know that her time was limited. And so we prayed, as any loving people would, and certainly a loving son would do, is we prayed for her healing. This cancer was aggressive. It eventually affected her speech, affected her mobility. But we prayed. We prayed for a miracle. God never healed her of her cancer. That cancer killed her. But God was, I think, a little bit more interested in this case for her and her situation, that she needed a different kind of healing. You see, my mom, for years, lived out broken relationships. It started certainly, or most vividly, in her divorce. But after that, it was relationship after relationship that was broken from the start and through it and by the end. And the church made space for her, which was very gracious and wonderful. And I think it really, it helped her kind of come back to God in some way. But it was through the cancer that God started to do something on her heart and soul that no person could ever do, no sermon could ever do. And we began to see this amazing transformation in her attitude, in her heart. Sometimes she would have a little bit of a chip on her shoulder or kind of a poor me attitude about life and about circumstances, probably for most of her life, and in some ways for good reason. But God started to heal her soul where that burden was lifted up. And times where she was really bitter towards certain people and had an kind of antagonism towards certain people, God changed and softened her heart, where people that I would be angry at, she's like, Cal, no, just love the person. I'm like, no, he said this to you. It doesn't matter. I love this person. I forgive this person. Her heart changed fundamentally. And so at her funeral, I was here at this spot, and I had talked about the love that I had for my wife, but certainly the love that God had for her, that God did not heal her physically. But when she died, I knew without a doubt she was made well. And she exuded that, and she encouraged others to do that, and it was a beautiful sight. If you are here this morning, figuratively hanging around a pool, hoping that there's some sort of magical properties in something that will make you better, or a right book, or the right person, the right thing to say, or the right Bible passage just to make it perfect, but are continually disappointed because you're not looking to Jesus? Can I consider you to look at a different focal point? Instead of looking in and you're down here, start to look up. And say, I've tried all this other stuff and it doesn't work. I want to try Jesus for once. And some of you have been follower of Jesus for a long time, and yet you're still by the pool. Can I just remind you? It's not the water. It's not the pool. It's still your Savior. He is the only one. He is the only one that will bring about the lasting change that you are so desperately, innerly crying out for. He's the only one that you can put your faith in, where your hope will last. That's my challenge for all of us, followers of Jesus or not yet followers of Jesus, to look to Jesus and be willing to stand, to pick up our mat and walk. Visually and experientially, I came across this clip. I thought this demonstrates this scene quite well. Let's just go ahead and play that video clip. It's from the TV series called The Chosen.
Shalom. Me? Yes.
Shalom.
I have a question for you.
For me. I don't have many answers, but I'm listening.
Do you want to be healed?
Who are you?
We'll get to that later. But my question remains.
Will you take me to the water? Look, I'm having a really bad day.
You've been having a bad day for a long time. So?
Sir, I have no one to help me into the water when it's stirred up. And when I do get close, the others step down in front of me. And so,
look at me. That's not what I asked. I'm not asking you about who's helping you, or who's not helping, or who's getting in your way. I'm asking about you.
I've tried.
You're still here. Why? So let's go. Get up, pick up your mat, and walk.
Walk, like he said. Don't forget your bed.
Why does this matter?
Because you're not coming back here. That life is over. Everything changes now.